Hey y'all, this is Jeannie. I use she, her pronouns, and you're listening to Sex Talk Happy Hour. Today, you're actually going to be hearing from my amazing supervisor and colleague, Josie Torrielli. She is the Assistant Director of Intervention and Best Care Programs here and has always been really passionate and involved with our annual Celebration of Excellence. A quick note, you might hear some background noise in these interviews here and there, just one of the perks of recording a podcast in New York City. Okay, let's get to Josie. She interviews three amazing people. I'm gonna shut up and let her fill you in.
Hey everyone, my name is Josie and I am the Assistant Director of Intervention Programs here at the Alliance. Today, you'll be hearing me interview three of the six honorees of the annual Lydia Martinez Multidisciplinary Collaboration Awards. Quick background. Lydia Martinez worked tirelessly to meet the needs of sexual assault victims in New York City. As a special victims detective, she spearheaded multidisciplinary initiatives aimed at improving systems response to survivors and championed a collaborative approach. The awards recognize excellent service and honor her legacy in recognizing that people and systems are most effective when they work together to assist survivors. Now, the details. Individuals are nominated by their peers across six different categories: Assistant District Attorney, NYPD Special Victims, Rape Crisis Professional, Sexual Violence Preventionist, Volunteer Rape Crisis Advocate, and Sexual Assault Forensic Examiner. Nominations are reviewed by Alliance staff, and awardees are selected by a committee comprised of the previous year's honorees. I then contact the awardees to let them know that they'll be honored, and honestly, it's one of the best parts of my job. All of this leads up to our Celebration of Excellence on May 7th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at Lavo Nightclub. This year is especially unique and exciting because we will also be honoring the founder of the Me Too movement, Tarana Burke. We can't wait to hear from Tarana about her incredible work and the activism that she has led and inspired. We really hope that you can come celebrate with us. You can buy tickets on our website or on our Eventbrite page. Details are in the episode notes. If you want to learn more about our honorees and for all things Alliance, make sure you follow us on our social media pages. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed getting to know the awardees as much as I did. So thank you so much for joining us today. Can you introduce yourself and tell our audience about your background and your work?
Sure, thank you. My name is Reiner Fahrenbeck. I'm a detective with the New York City Police Department. I joined the NYPD back in 1997, and I was promoted to detective in 2003. Currently, I'm working with the Midtown North Detective Squad, but prior to that, I worked for 8 years with the Special Victims Division and split most of my time there between child abuse investigations and special victims investigations.
Great. Okay, thanks. The Special Victims Division is a pretty specific role within the New York City Police Department. Can you tell us a little bit about why you chose to work there and what you felt like was important about, what were important qualities to have in working there?
When I was first a detective, I spent a bulk of my career in the Narcotics Division, doing undercover work and investigating drug cases. And then I was ready to move on, just wanted something different to do. It needed to be meaningful. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I started looking around at what was out there, and I found the Special Victims Division. I realized what was going to be important to me is that I made a difference. I needed to go to work every day and realize the work I'm doing is important, not just to me, but to somebody else. I really wanted that ability to have some sort of positive impact on somebody else's life.
Great. Okay, thanks. And what was the most rewarding part of being in that role of a special victims detective?
One of the most important things I realized pretty quickly is being able to work with so many different people, not just detectives, but so many multidisciplinary professionals, advocates, doctors, and so many other people involved. I realized so many of these people are very, very courageous and very dedicated. It takes a lot to do this kind of work, and I really appreciated being able to meet these people and to work with them.
Great. And as you know, your nomination was written by an advocate that you worked with in the emergency department. Can you talk to me a little bit about what it was like to know that someone outside of kind of your area of law enforcement nominated you? And can you talk a little bit about your response to being nominated?
Well, my response was definitely one of surprise. It was very surprising to actually know that somebody out there really did see something that I did. And apparently I did make a real positive impact on someone's life. I made their life a little bit better. And having it come from someone that was so unexpected really meant a lot to me. It really meant that apparently what I did was really good. And it was very nice to be acknowledged by someone outside the field.
Yeah. And what kind of qualities do you think are essential for a special victims detective investigator to have? What's been important, or what was important for the way that you approached working with victims of sexual assault?
I think the most important thing is not so much a law enforcement thing. It's more of a human thing. I think the most important thing to realize is that you're not just dealing with cases. You're dealing with people. You're dealing with a person that's gone through a very traumatic event, and that sets the tone for how you investigate these cases. I think it's very important to really try to understand what the person's going through and to try to respect them and to try to help them. It's so important to try to make their life better than when you first met them, and to make sure that they have a lot of say in what goes on. Anybody can, you know, investigate a case and, you know, interview people and search for suspects and collect evidence, but that's expected and that's necessary for so many parts of investigating any crime. But when you're dealing with cases involving survivors of sexual assault, it really is important at first to realize this is a person in front of you. It's not just a case. And you need to establish that relationship of trust and let them know that, hey, I am here with you and I'm not going to leave you. We're going to get through this together. And whatever you decide ultimately is what we're going to do. You know, it's very important to just not put unnecessary pressure on these survivors, you know, and to let them have a voice.
I really appreciate that you're saying that and that you're thinking about that, because, you know, as we know, part of the dynamics of sexual violence are a loss of control. And so it sounds like you're really aware of being able to help restore that as being an important step in the process.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So I'm curious about, as you know, we are honoring Tarana Burke at this year's ceremony on May 7th. She's the founder of the Me Too movement. I'm wondering what sort of impact that movement has had on your work. What have the impacts been? What have you seen?
Well, I mean, everybody's heard of the Me Too movement, and, you know, everybody's aware of, you know, the hashtag Me Too, but it really does go so much deeper than that, you know, so much more beyond just a statement and a hashtag. And I was fortunate enough to see the impact of what it really meant. You know, for so long now, sexual assault crimes have been ignored, or they've carried a stigma. It's something nobody wanted to talk about. And it's been something that, you know, people dismissed as not being worthy, perhaps, of, you know, the attention that it should get. I feel like this Me Too movement really gave a voice to survivors, you know, otherwise would have gone unheard, or were too afraid, or felt like they were in this alone. You know, I think as time has progressed, there are so many more resources now, there's so much more information, and that, you know, survivors of sexual assault, they are able now to, you know, to understand their rights, to understand that they're going to be heard, you know, they're not going to be forced to do things they don't want to do. And I feel like reporting has definitely gone up. I think more people are not afraid anymore. I think they want to come forward, and I think they want, you know, justice to be served. And we all feel in this community that, you know, the people that commit these crimes, they should face justice. They should be prosecuted for what they did. But I think now it's not just a law enforcement thing. It's everybody's involved, and everybody has that one mission, not only just to, you know, have somebody face, you know, charges in court, but to really help the survivors of these assaults, you know, just get control of their lives again, and to make sure that they are heard. And I think the Me Too movement definitely, you know, has had a very positive impact on the way these cases are handled on all levels.
Great. Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of it is about just reducing some of the isolation that people experience when they've survived sexual violence, and just letting people know that they're not alone and that their voices can be heard. I've so appreciated getting to know you through your nomination and through this conversation. I'm interested to think about how will you be celebrating with us on May 7th? What's going to be important about that night for you?
First, I really am truly honored for this nomination, and I really do appreciate it very much. I'm looking forward to celebrating this achievement by being with the people in the field that do this every day. You know, it's going to be nice to see everyone that's involved in, you know, all of these processes that go on. I'm especially looking forward to bringing my wife Krista. I think it'll be a great time. You know, unfortunately, because of the work we do, it's not always stuff we talk about at home. It's not stuff that, you know, our significant others and families actually get to see the positive impact that we have. And I think it'll be a great way for us to actually see that.
I agree. Well, thank you so much, Reiner. We're so looking forward to presenting you with your award. And thank you so much for all of the people that you've impacted and the way that you've worked within the Special Victims Division. We really appreciate taking the time today and all that you've done. And any final thoughts?
I just want to say thank you very much for this. And I really do appreciate, you know, the work that you do and that everybody does, you know, to make a difference.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Great. So thank you so much for being with us today. Can you just introduce yourself by your name and your role that you were being awarded for?
Yes. So my name is Jennifer Ware, and I am a survivor advocate with Mount Sinai Savvy Program.
Great. Thank you. Jennifer, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, thank you.
Can you describe for people in the audience who might not know, what does a survivor advocate do?
Yes, of course. So I've been working with Mount Sinai's Savvy program for about 3 years now. As an advocate, I go into emergency departments in Queens and Manhattan to provide support for survivors who've come in after either a sexual assault or some sort of intimate partner violence. And in the emergency department, my main role is to provide a sort of emotional first aid for people who've just been through something really traumatic, but I'm also there to help guide them through some of their legal and medical options while they're in the hospital, to advocate for the survivor's wishes to other folks they might encounter there, whether it's doctors, nurses, or police, and sometimes to provide support for co-survivors who might be in the emergency department with a survivor.
Great. And how did you start? This is a volunteer role, right?
Yes.
Okay. And how did you start? How did you come into this role, or what brought you to becoming an advocate?
So I think I came to Savvy for a reason that is shared by a lot of other volunteers, which is that sexual violence has touched my life in many ways. I myself am a survivor, and so many people that I love have been through something that involves sexual violence. And so a lot of those experiences can be really paralyzing, and I think it's not uncommon for people to feel sort of overwhelmed by that. And so I wanted to do something constructive. I wanted to sort of try to make something out of those experiences. And whenever I realized that being a volunteer advocate was a thing and that people were able to do this, I really couldn't stop talking about it. I knew right away that that's how I wanted to spend, you know, my time and energy as a volunteer.
Great. Yeah. And I think, you know, that role is really important for people that are within the emergency department, both for the patient and for the team that's around that patient. Can you talk about how the advocate role is important and why that role is so essential?
Absolutely. So I work with lots of different folks in the ED, you know, who are coming from lots of different backgrounds to come together and support survivors. But I really think in some ways I have the best job, and I'm sort of the luckiest because I'm just there to provide whatever kind of support this person needs. I don't have any other goals I have to accomplish. There's nothing I have to do other than be there for someone. And I think that's why advocates are so important. When you're in an emergency department, which is already a place that most of us don't want to find ourselves, and there's a lot happening and there are a lot of people asking you questions, to have someone who has nowhere else they have to be and nothing else they have to do, who's just there to listen and to believe you and to advocate for what you want, I think can really make a huge difference in people's road to sort of recovery and to normalizing their, you know, finding some normalcy in their lives after a traumatic experience.
Yeah, I agree. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to collaborate with the team members who are also working with a patient in that environment?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a lot of people, as I mentioned, who come together in these situations, you know, often multiple doctors and nurses, sometimes a forensic examiner or police and detectives who might be involved, social workers and so on. I've had some really incredible experiences working with these teams. In my experience, people usually want to do the best job they can to support the survivors that we're seeing in the emergency departments. And people do come to the table sometimes with a lot of expertise and a lot of education about what it's like to go through a sexual assault. And sometimes people don't know what to expect or what to do, but are, you know, really willing to collaborate and, you know, and learn from the people around them.
So, Jennifer, what keeps you in that role as advocate? Because I hear that it's incredibly essential and that it's something that you're really passionate about. But what I'm also imagining is that there are challenges. And so what keeps you in the role?
So certainly one of the things that I hear somewhat often whenever I tell people that I volunteer in emergency departments, providing support for folks who've undergone something traumatic, is that it's probably really sad and it's probably really hard. And both of those things are true sometimes. It certainly can be. But it's also often incredibly inspiring. So because I'm spending usually hours with someone, often alone, it's just me and the survivor for much of the time. There are difficult moments and sad moments, but there are also really beautiful moments of joy. You know, I usually laugh with survivors at some point during my time with them. I find out about their lives, and it's a deeply human experience and connection that I always feel fortunate to have had the opportunity to share with a person. So there's this balance to the difficulty of just really sort of beautiful human moments. But also, I've been very rewarded in this work by getting to meet so many incredible people, from the Savvy staff to other Savvy advocates, other members of the survivor support team. And all of these people are sort of incredible examples of how kind humans are capable of being and how brave we can be to look at things that are difficult and hard and sad and not turn away. And also the survivors themselves are such tremendously inspiring people who are showing resilience in the face of difficulty by even being in the emergency department and talking about what they've gone through and reaching out to other people for help.
Yes, I think that's a really important frame, is to thinking about survivors not just as a word that we use to describe someone, but really thinking about that term survived and thinking about that from a position of strength and resiliency.
Absolutely, absolutely. To think about survivors as people who've just been through something hard is really to end the story far too early.
Exactly, yeah. And then to think about surviving and then thriving, right?
Right.
So I'm also curious, as you know, we are hosting Tarana Burke, and we're really honored that she'll be able to celebrate with us on May 7th. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts about the Me Too movement and the impact that it's had on your role, or the impact on the work, or where you see this fitting into the conversation around survivorship.
Yeah, I definitely have some thoughts on the Me Too movement, and I'm so excited to be celebrating it in this way. I talk about sexual violence a good bit in my life as a volunteer advocate. I talk about it sometimes in court, where I also represent Savvy. I talk about it in my classrooms. I have the honor of teaching a philosophy and feminism course sometimes within the CUNY system. But I think that something that's been really wonderful that's come out of the Me Too movement is that it's drawn attention to sexual violence, and it's drawn attention from folks who otherwise might not be talking about or thinking about it. So it's really opened up this opportunity to talk about the existence and pervasiveness of sexual assault with folks who otherwise might not be engaged with those issues. And I really think that most people care about being good to one another, and most of us want to do the right thing, and we don't want to hurt each other or be sort of complicit in systems that are hurtful. But sometimes we just don't recognize, or we don't know how the things we do or don't do, or the things we say or don't say, can strongly impact other people. So I think that these conversations that the Me Too movement has generated really give us the opportunity to become more aware, and in becoming more aware, more compassionate, and to become more accountable to each other.
Great. Yes, I definitely agree. I know that when we spoke and when I let you know that you were being recognized by your peers and by your community, I know that you had said that this was really big news for you. I'm wondering how you're feeling about the award, and also how you'll be celebrating with us on May 7th. What are you looking forward to about that night?
This is going to be the hardest question to answer because I don't really have the words to describe how excited I am, but tremendously thrilled and honored. It's something that really means the world to me. If there's anything I hope I'm doing well, it's providing, you know, support for people who need it, and trying to put some kindness into the world. And so this really means more to me than anything I could imagine. And I can't wait to spend time with the other recipients of the award and other professionals in this field. Because again, one of the best parts of this job and one of the most rewarding parts of being an advocate is that I've just met tremendously wonderful, kind, caring folks.
That's lovely. Oh, wow. So, Jennifer, we're so looking forward to honoring you and celebrating with you on May 7th. And thank you so much for taking the time today to talk with me.
Thank you so much. And thanks for all you do.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Can you just introduce yourself? Let us know your name and what you do at Columbia and what that entails.
Sure. Hi. So my name is Jolie Iannuso. I'm the Violence Prevention Educator with Sexual Violence Response and Rape Crisis Anti-Violence Support Center. That's a really long title, so you can call us SVR. And that's over, as you said, with Columbia University. My role is actually pretty unique to Columbia SVR in that I do both prevention and advocacy work. So usually our folks sort of do one or the other, but through the Enough is Enough state law, which funds my position, I have the opportunity to get to do both. So what that means is I help out with our 24/7, 365-day-a-year helpline, and I will take on-call shifts and respond to students in crisis in real time for accompaniments to SVD or over to, let's say, St. Luke's for a safe. So really anything that a student may be needing in that moment. I also do lots of prevention work, but the way in which I do prevention is also a little bit unique to Sexual Violence Response in that I am not only available to all 27 affiliates of Columbia University to train those students from our new student orientation programs to student leaders programs, all the way through requested programming from a student group, but I also have the opportunity to train administrators both from Columbia University and outside of Columbia University if they're interested in learning how to better address their own student bodies around sexual violence and the prevention of sexual violence.
Great, thank you. How do you think that the two go together? So you're describing two roles, and how do you think the advocacy work that you do kind of informs or interacts with then the prevention and training work? Do you see any intersections there?
Absolutely. So as an educator formally, the advocacy role is not necessarily what I would call my bread and butter, and it's also extremely informative for me in figuring out how best to do my prevention work. So in learning more about what it is to truly be one-on-one with a student in the wake of a sexually violent episode, it helps me determine a little bit better what trauma-informed education can look like, for example. Or when people are asking questions during a training around, what is it like to go get a safe? What is it like to go into SVD or to talk to police? I'm able to have a better grasp on those things through my advocacy work. But I think prevention and response are intrinsically related, just in that in order to prevent something, we need to know what it is. And in order to respond, that's that same idea. What is it that we're really considering? What's happening to somebody? What healing needs to happen so that the violence doesn't continue? I think a lot of times folks will think that somebody who is a perpetrator or is somebody who's doing harm cannot also be somebody who has been harmed. You know, it's possible to be both a survivor and somebody who has done harm to somebody else. So really making those connections between the advocacy and the prevention work, I think it's been unbelievably invaluable to me as an educator and as an advocate. I think they're just so intrinsically related. It is sometimes hard to pierce them apart.
Yeah, and I'm appreciating that you're bringing that up, because I think often those two elements of the work are treated very separately, intervention and prevention, along with examining people who have been harmed and people who are doing harm. So I appreciate that you're forming those connections in your work. How did you come into this role at SVR? How did you get started, or how did you choose to come specifically to this place in your career?
A lot of people, I think, in the work who I've met often say that they sort of fell into it. And I don't necessarily feel that I did fall into it. I guess sort of. When I was in undergrad, I started my undergraduate studies in a very small screenwriting and playwriting program at Drexel University. And I quickly figured out for myself that if I were to create characters, I wanted those characters to be connected to who they really were, their histories as humans. So right away, instead of only taking my required courses, I was taking courses in anthropology, in sociology, in Africana studies, women and gender studies, queer theory, really trying to figure out how I could best understand histories of people that are not necessarily the same as me, who are in fact very different than I am. And taking those classes, I realized that was where my real passions were. Identity politics, specifically LGBT and queer politics. In part, I think I was looking a little bit for myself in taking those classes as an undergraduate student. There was a little bit of selfishness in figuring some of those identity politics out. But I quickly understood that I couldn't just read bell hooks and Michel Foucault alone and understand everything that they were saying in their writing. I really needed to be with other people to talk things out, to learn, to make mistakes. And so I needed a classroom setting for that much more than I did for screenwriting and playwriting. So I fairly quickly changed my major, which also led me to changing my schools, and that brought me to Barnard College. Through an alum of Barnard, I heard about a program at Widener University, which is in Pennsylvania, and at the time it was the only accredited human sexualities program in the country for advanced degrees. So I applied there and only there and was accepted into the program, and I earned a Master's of Education specifically in human sexuality. And in my mind, all sex education is violence prevention education, because if we're teaching people what healthy relationships look like, what boundaries look like, what pleasure is, how to seek pleasure, how to take ownership of our own, I think we're also teaching people what to stay away from. And so I knew that I wanted to be a part of that. I feel very lucky to be where I am at Columbia, especially with it being my alma mater.
That's really wonderful. It sounds like it's been such an interesting and rich path toward where you are right now. What are the challenges that you're experiencing in doing the work?
One thing I often find is, although there are amazing educators sort of across the board, sort of regardless of what discipline they're coming from, very often there aren't other folks with degree backgrounds like myself. And so I find myself as being one of the only formally educated educators in a space pretty often. And although that's a challenge, I actually see it more as a benefit in being able to really hone in on that idea of what it is to be multidisciplinary and be able to provide this other perspective and work with people from across disciplines all of the time. Adding in the lens of sex positivity is one of the things I try to do, and I hope I do, but really this idea that as long as the sex is consensual and okay, that that person is doing what is good for them. There's a lot of buzzwords in the field, and one of the phrases that comes to mind is meeting people where they are. And sometimes that's, I think, one of the hardest things to do, is to very genuinely meet people where they are. Because sometimes where people are is in a violent place. And I don't necessarily mean physically, but the values, the thoughts, the biases. Sometimes that's where people are. Taking that step back and realizing if somebody's using language that is violent or not okay, or somebody holds beliefs that are really violent for somebody with a particular identity or background, how do we do that? How do we meet them exactly where they are and move them forward a little bit? That type of work is extremely challenging to do, especially when in prevention we often get an hour once a year with a couple hundred people in a room.
Right. I think that is the challenge, is to engage the audience and to kind of teach to everyone who's in the room at varying levels of knowledge and places in their knowledge. Can you talk about an experience that was particularly like maybe a short story about a classroom experience or a training experience that was particularly rewarding or that stands out for you?
I actually, pretty recently when I was doing some work with some administrators, I had a very small group, and it was a full day workshop. I was expecting upwards of 20 folks, and I had 6 show up. And so on the fly, I have to change a lot of the way in which I was going to present the workshop, because the difference between 20 and 6 and how we do activities can be pretty big. And so a lot of what we ended up doing was sitting around the same table, just all of us, and having really big conversations. And we were talking about the difference between risk reduction education and not telling somebody the ways in which they will not be a victim. And there was this really fantastic, challenging conversation that was happening between myself and some of the participants who were coming mainly from law backgrounds. For me, one of the moments that always really is the best as an educator is when I can sort of see somebody getting it a little bit more, or clicking, or having a new realization and leaning into that. And I think in this particular space with this conversation, it was happening for all of us, myself included. I think I left there, and according to the evaluations I had, the folks left there having felt as if there was this 360-degree education happening.
Great, thank you. And so speaking of conversations, as you know, we're hosting Tarana Burke at our celebration on May 7th. And I'm wondering your thoughts around the Me Too movement and what changes or impacts you've seen as a result of this movement or this moment in time that we're in.
I think with hashtag Me Too, people outside of violence prevention, education, and response are really talking about the issues and learning about sexual violence. I think it's helping people feel empowered to speak up and to seek services and to heal, and that it's helping people understand that it's not just about the low bar of the law, but really about the higher bars of ethics and morals. One thing that always stands out to me around the idea of empowerment, I don't know if I find that Me Too on its own is what is empowering to others, but the tools that it provides is. The tools that Me Too is presenting, which is being able to talk to people posting about what the resources are, where they can go for help, more websites popping up, more organizations talking about everything. And that's the piece that's really important, and the difference between empowerment. As an educator, as an advocate, I can never empower somebody else, but I can provide them the tools for them to feel empowered.
Thank you. Jolie, I'm wondering for, you know, as our celebration approaches and as we're getting ready to come together and to celebrate your achievements and your co-awardees' achievements, I'm wondering what you're looking forward to on that night and what that night will mean to you.
So my parents have already bought, they are super excited, have already bought a 10 block of tickets. I think they have upwards of an additional 6 family members coming, including myself and my partner. And I'm really excited to be able to share that with them. I couldn't be doing what I'm doing today without their support. It also happens to be 3 days before my birthday, so it's making for quite a good week. I begin my birthday week with this amazing award and beautiful celebration, and end it with beginning a new year.
Thank you, and I'm so happy to hear that. And one of the big joys of my role in this process is being able to get to know colleagues on a deeper level, their work and who they are. What was it like for you to know that you were nominated by your peers and selected by your peers? I know that when we first spoke and, you know, I kind of made that phone call to you, you said, I think you said, I'm overwhelmed, but I'm wondering what it was like to just understand that, you know, you were receiving this award.
I think I did use the word overwhelmed, and definitely in a positive way, not a bad overwhelmed. I mean, to know on interpersonal levels that I have these wonderful relationships, I think has always been sort of enough. For the folks who had nominated me, I mean, I know I have wonderful working relationships with them and care about them, but that extra step, the one more step of I'm going to take time out of my day, and I know that it's busy days, to fill out this form and to think of you in that way, that's the part I think that felt really special and positively overwhelming. I love what I do, and I also have been doing it for not so long, at least not formally. And so to have that recognition, to have made an impact already, feels big and humbling.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you for the work that you do. And we're really looking forward to celebrating with you and your partner and with your family and with your colleagues on May 7th. We can't wait to have that night come and to be able to celebrate you and your achievements.
I'm excited. I can't wait to celebrate everybody else.
Wow. Aren't all of these folks amazing? And Josie absolutely killed it with these interviews, right? I don't know about you, but it always gives me such hope to hear from people who are doing incredible work in the field. We're so excited to celebrate and lift up the accomplishments of all 6 of our honorees, as well as the inimitable Tarana Burke. Wait, what's that? You want to celebrate them too? Well, as luck would have it, anyone who wants to attend the ceremony can. Every year, our Celebration of Excellence is attended by over 200 people, and this year, we hope that you'll be one of them. Ticket prices are still open, and you can purchase your tickets on our website at svfreenyc.org, or check out the episode details of this podcast to find the direct link. This year's ceremony, as it's been referred to over and over again, will be held on Monday, May 7th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at Lavo Restaurant and Nightclub. Come join us for drinks, snacks, silent auction prizes, and of course, to celebrate the people who work tirelessly for survivors and victims of sexual violence. All proceeds of this event support the programs at the New York City Alliance Against Sexual Assault, and if you can't make it in person, but you still want to support us, you can always donate through our website. Thank you to the Alliance staff who helped make this podcast possible. To Josie for hosting this episode, for killing these interviews. You did such an amazing job. Thank you so much. To Nikki Cruz, who is our social media guru and makes everything run so smoothly. To Terry Rosenberg, our communications director, who worked endlessly to make sure that our annual celebration of excellence runs without a hitch. And finally, to all of our honorees, all 6 of you and Tarana, we can't wait to celebrate you on May 7th. Remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or Google Play, and tell your friends to do the same. And if you want to get in touch with us, or you have feedback or thoughts, or you have a topic that you want us to talk about, you can tweet at us at NYCAASA, or just message us on Instagram at NYCAlliance. Make sure you use our hashtag SexTalkHappyHour, all one word. Thank you so much for listening in. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. We hope to see you there at Lavo Nightclub on May 7th. Ciao for now, and we'll see you next time.